This is an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with John Petrie from NTT Security.
Good morning, Ian. I'm the Global Chief Information Security Officer for NTT Security. I have offices in four regions. Our regions currently are the United States, the Americas, EMEA, Europe, Middle East and Africa, Asian Pacific, and Japan, in our case, will always be its own region. We're a Japanese-owned company. NTT Security was formed in August of 2016 by combining four principal companies internally that NTT owned and created NTT Security. To date, we have approximately 10 security operations centers across the globe. We are now in the process of integrating and rationalizing about 11 platforms together to become a single MSS platform moving forward. One of the challenges that global CISOs have today, in my opinion, in talking to my colleagues who are our clients, is really the integration of cultures and the integration of various tool sets that work in individual country environments. Language continues to be a concern moving forward, and combining those languages in order to get to the individual employees that are in multinational or multicultural areas. So that's always very difficult to do.
One of the challenges that most global CISOs face when they step into a large organization is actually understanding what the threat position is. What assets do they have? How aligned or misaligned is security across an entire group, let alone one individual division? How do they begin to get a handle on this?
They begin by the organizational structure. Where do they individually sit within the organization? Today, for myself, I sit on the executive team. I report into the board when required. I actually am a voting member on the executive team, so I have full access and I'm sitting at the table, if you will. That gives me a lot of capabilities, where as opposed to some of my colleagues in the CSO community who don't sit at the table, the challenges are a little bit more from a communications perspective. In my particular case, and my advice to my fellow CSOs, of course, is communication is key here. You must understand where those assets are located at, what is at your fingertips. And in our current organization, we're a matrix organization. When I say matrix, it really is around organizational structure and the ability to be behind the scenes and still get the job done. So you have levers that you can pull to excite or to engage with the rest of the organization. In NTT Security case, think of us as a factory. And the example that I'm going to give is really around, let's say, threat intelligence. NTT Security as a company, I'm a client as well as part of the organization, as well as a C-level CXO. So as a customer, I get the same threat intelligence as our clients do from internal, from our threat management organization globally, which is very interesting. And again, this is an example. There's several other areas that I'm considered a client, and that works out very well. It gives me two things. Of course, it gives me the ability to use information and to manage my security controls within the company, but it also gives me insight to what the other clients, our clients, are seeing, what problems they may have, because I experience exactly the same things that they are.
Can you give us just some insight into those challenges that you get on a daily basis?
I get a lot of challenges on a daily basis. Let's stay away from the cultural areas, the issues with regulatory requirements and those kinds of things for a moment. From a technical perspective, the challenges that I have in a lot of cases is on the reporting end. I am a client to my managed security services. All of my SIM, all of my logging, all my detailed analysis, our advanced analytics, goes through our system internally that services our clients. So I get that for my devices. The reporting is a challenge in the sense that if you're a global company, that information today for our centralized location is English, international English. If you're in Japan, you want to see those reporting in Japanese. And so what we've had to do is create translation engines with our reporting. And in some cases, that doesn't always come out exactly the way it probably should. That's a big challenge, because when you're talking about reporting and actionable information, you want that to be as accurate as possible. And for the most part, it is. But when you talk about language barriers as a global company, it's difficult to make sure that that information is the same information that's going around the world. Translation is difficult in a lot of languages, French, German, Chinese, Japanese, and that's a difficult part. I don't know that we still have 100%. Machine learning is helping us get there. It's much better than it was, say, even 2 years ago, let alone 10 years ago, where everything had to be done by pencil and paper. That's one of the major challenges, is really around the reporting stream. Again, our clients are very comfortable with our reporting, but as a client myself, I look at that, I'm much more critical, if you will. It's my company, I want to make sure that I'm getting the right information as well as our client. We tend to take a look at breaking everything apart and doing an analytical exercise against what we're receiving. Reporting is usually a challenge. So that's one example. There's many more.
How do you feedback your issues? Because you're a customer. Therefore, one presumes that your voice carries no more weight than any other customer when you're unhappy with something. How responsive do you find your teams have become since you've been in the role? And how much more do you think you've got to go to get them to react as fast as you need as a customer, which has to be the same as your commercial customers?
We're doing really well at that at this point. We're regionally divided, so we get our MSS support in four different regions. When there's an issue within that region, that goes up through a service delivery manager or a customer service manager, depending on which region you're in. We have several different titles based on countries and culture. They're all the same. They're the person that I, as a client, as a customer, will go to and say, I have this issue. You didn't see this event take shape, or you didn't correlate, in our opinion, properly. What happens then for both the client and myself is when those issues, and they are rare, but when they do happen, that person is responsible for taking it from the entry point, the report point, all the way to resolution. And so there's a single person that's required to do that. We do that same thing. We have a service delivery manager assigned to my teams. There's four of those, obviously. Four regions, four service delivery managers. And when we have an event that we have a concern about, that person will get on a conference call with the teams. Rarely is it a global issue. It's usually a regional issue. But because events are global, you have to think ahead and you have to be more proactive than reactive. So if an event causes a question like that in, say, APAC, you want to get the teams together across all the regions, in our case, and say, okay, is this affecting everywhere else? Is there a correlation that might indicate that this is a global attack? Where is it coming from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's followed through until it's resolved. Is it truly an incident? Do we need to escalate? If we need to escalate, what's the process and the procedures to escalate those? And each of our clients has an escalation procedure based on their business model. So for us, ours is a little bit different, I would believe, than maybe a retail organization.
How much of an advantage is it when determining product strategy for you to be both the owner of the products at the end of the day, but also a consumer and customer of the products? Because one of the challenges we have in cybersecurity is integration and smoothness of handover of data.
That's a double-edged sword in a lot of cases. So I'm not sure there's an advantage, but I think when I take a look at that, listening to your question, I take a look at our landscape, for example. I participate in product selection. As the company moves forward with selecting products to provide to our clients and our customers, I participate in that. So I get a bird's eye view of all the testing, all the retrograde operations, looking at individual products and solutions and how we would move those into a client environment purely from an MSS perspective. But also, if our consultants are going to recommend products, we need to understand what those products are. I am always of the belief that if I'm going to recommend a product to my colleagues, my CISOs that are clients, I want to make sure I'm using that product in some capacity. Either I'm using that product as a client, I'm receiving it as a client, or in my internal security framework, I'm using those products to do internal specific targeted product usage. Not to give any specific product a blurb here, but as an example, we use Qualys both as a service offering for our clients, but we also use it internally to our environment, our enterprise. I can legitimately say that I use it myself, my organization uses it, and I also am a receiving on the client side. When it comes to making a decision at the product board level, I have a vote, a single vote that is equal to all the other votes within the committee, within the board, to select a product. Sometimes that's a good thing and I can provide influence because I might really believe in that product from my experience. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it'll be overruled for a lot of different reasons as it relates to, say, deployment or ease of managing a certain solution. So there are contributing factors. It is a give and take, but the keynote I'd say to all my CISO colleagues is that I can't emphasize enough about being at the table. In this particular case, I sit at the product board level. And so I do have input at that level. So I can influence in some cases, but I have a vote. And that's key when you're talking about a global company. Because what's right for the Americas may not be right for European, certainly as it relates to privacy issues like GDPR. Those solutions may be different. There may be different ramifications. And so that discussion has to be had. And if you're having that, then you're really embarking on the road of security by design at that point. Because now you're saying, hey, this is from a security viewpoint. Here's what we believe this product is good for or not good for. And you get the product management, the product delivery, the product teams get that input directly at the beginning before they even move on to testing. And so there's a lot of give and take there. One final note on this topic, and that is that I have technical people on my team that will participate in testing or alphas or beta testing processes. So we'll be able to go in there and actually do testing from an engineer level.
How do you drive global adoption and standardization across the whole of the group that you work with? Because you're not one company, you're a conglomeration of companies. Therefore, people will have had their own buying decisions in the past, but those buying decisions may not align with where you want to go. Is it easy to get everybody to buy into what's needed in the future? And if not, what would you say to other people in your position?
So let me clarify the question first. Are we talking about NTT security, or are we talking about NTT as a global organization?
Talking about NTT as a global organization.
Okay. It's much easier, of course, at NTT security level, where we're talking about a single company, multiple entities globally, but it's a single company. When we talk about NTT globally, we're talking about various powerhouses within the industry. So Dimension Data, NTT Data, NTT Communications, Docomo, and you're talking about selecting a product that we're going to move across all of those entities. Much more difficult to do. Where the discussion happens on products or where we're going to go is really at the global CISO committee level. I sit along with the other representatives of the companies within NTT globally. We sit on CISO committee chaired by the Honorable Shinohara-san, who is the global CISO for NTT. When product selections are coming up, for example, if NTT Research, R&D, develops a solution or a tool that they would like to put out into the market or maybe just use within NTT as a proprietary tool, that's brought up to the committee and we have a discussion. And anybody that is part of a Japanese company will note that there's a lot of discussion, a lot of planning that goes on within a Japanese company framework. I believe that's a good thing, but I also believe that we need to be more actionable. So at this committee level, it's briefed by the technical person or persons that developed a solution. It's brought up for discussion. Everybody leaves that and goes and does their own research or has their own discussions, and then it comes back, and then those solutions are put in then into the company product guide. Then you could make a selection off of that guide. That's how we do it. In other companies, I've seen where it's mandated and you just do it. I think there's room for that in certain cases. Certainly, there's benefits of doing it by committee and doing it autocratically because NTT security is so new. Remember, for the audience, August 2016 is when NTT security became a company. And so we're still transforming, but I think in the future, it would be my goal and my desire that NTT security would provide that direction to all NTT companies within the NTT family. That way, I think there's going to be some things that would be more autocratic. The other thing is on the research and development side, getting research and development projects out to the market has been a challenge for us. Not in the Japanese market, because we're a Japanese company, it goes pretty quickly, but to get it from Japan research and development out to the rest of the world has been a challenge for us. We're in the process of working through that, maybe getting more speed to market on some of our research and development, which is very good. It just generally doesn't get there fast enough, and that's, again, my opinion.
Early on, you mentioned both culture and regulation. Let's deal with culture. Culture is a challenge in terms of understanding why various people fall prey to certain types of attack. But it's also a cultural issue when we talk about sharing data, admitting to failure, admitting to mistakes, being willing to change a system that you've been responsible for putting in. How much does cybersecurity globally suffer from cultural barriers that it needs to remove if it's going to be seamless for organizations?
Certainly culture is, for any global CISO, the cultural framework of that company is very important and certainly a challenge. As we talk about cybersecurity as a strategy itself, The first thing I think you need to establish, and certainly I've established this, it's a business problem. It's not a technical issue. It's not a CIO function. It's not some black box sitting out there. So culturally, we need to change the mindset of our executive teams that this is a business problem now. Security crosses all lines of business, all functional areas. Every place we talk about, IoT, IT, every area of a business is affected by cybersecurity rules and the culture of those rules. Openness is absolutely critical. Our first line of defense, and again, I'm talking about entity security at this point, our first line of defense are employees. As a security company, we have a lot of smart people in the cybersecurity areas in various disciplines. You get a lot of smart people in a room. You get 10 people in a room, you get 10 opinions, and they're all different. But in my opinion, you have to groom that openness. They have to be able to come to me, and either by email or by phone call or whatever communications vehicle they choose to use, they need to provide that input. What are they seeing? Either it's from engineering or it's from client's perspective, solutions that are being put in, how they're integrated with other parts of the business. If they're a manufacturer, is it affecting their manufacturing system by putting in too many controls? Those kinds of open commentary back to me helps me do a better job in assigning control frameworks for my organization. Now, currently, from a framework perspective, we use ISO 27001 and 2 as our baseline, as a lot of companies do. We're global. It works very nicely into our business model. However, I think we're going to start seeing more movement towards a more international NIST standard, whatever that's going to look like at some point. The reason I bring that up is that that allows for some cultural changes that will occur. The ability to pinpoint in each individual culture's areas that are the most concern, whether that's phishing, how an employee becomes prey to a phishing attack or clicking on a link somewhere within a website and downloading something that they probably shouldn't have to. And then on top of that, of course, the perimeter is disintegrated now. So we have the mobile issue to deal with. I think a lot of the cultural things you have to harness that. What I mean by harnessing that is that you have to combine the cultural experience of that individual, whether it's Japanese, whether it's German, whether it's English, and how they view the world. In order to do that, at least from my perspective, I have to have staff in those areas who understand those cultural differences. And then you tie security training, awareness training, if you will, to everyday life. Things that can help their children, perhaps, that they can help them with their parents, elderly, those kinds of things. And that's, again, another openness about using culture to your advantage. So those are some examples. Again, I want to wrap this section up by saying it's a challenge. And anybody that's a global CIO that says it doesn't a challenge, I'm not sure I would believe that, because every day changes. Every movement by a national government changes the cultural differences within a country. Those are very important things that a global CISO has to manage. And one more thing, working with your individual HR departments, your communications departments, becomes also critical. If you sign up for the strategy that cybersecurity, information security, data security is a business function, then there's business issues that you have to deal with. A lot of us come up through the technical areas, so we're more familiar with technical issues, but the business issues such as communications and HR-related events and those kinds of things, you have to work a little bit harder to work with those functional areas that maybe you did in the past because you were technical. That's also a challenge.
Regulation is the other big area. You've mentioned GDPR. The challenge we have is there are some things that make sense globally from regulation. People's privacy, making sure data breaches are talked about quickly, dealt with, and any penalties are applied fairly across the globe. However, there are other issues that sit underneath that. We've started to see countries being much more protective about what data can be moved beyond their borders, which kind of runs against the whole idea of cloud and other methods that we've sought to bring in. How do you approach the whole complexity of reporting at national, at local, and even at regional levels?
An extremely difficult challenge. Let me take it from a perspective of a security company. The data that we are having for our clients, as a security company, we keep a lot of log files for our clients. And in those log files are supposed to be very specific information, non-personal identifiable, or be able to take that data and track it back to an individual. By design, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for very technical data. Not always the case. So if a customer, for example, has a data dump into their log files, there could be all sorts of information in there, credit card numbers, individual names, addresses. If something happens to their system, we will collect that information. privacy is absolutely a key element of our strategy moving forward. There's no difference between our employees and our clients' employees. Everybody's privacy must be secured or at least anonymized so that their individual designation as an individual is safeguarded. I'm choosing words very carefully here because we're not talking about machines. We're talking about individual people and entities. As you design solutions, and we're currently redesigning our global managed security service platform today, we're combining 11, 12, whatever number it's going to be, we're combining that together to make a single platform. One of the things we have to address from a privacy perspective, and specifically for GDPR and Chinese cybersecurity law, is that we have to be able to anonymize the data as early as possible in the process. Because if we're going to do advanced analytics, you have to have the data. The issue really becomes, at least in our view, an issue of communications, making sure that the client is aware and making sure that we don't just leave that client with the responsibility to notify their customers. We need to be proactive and make sure that they are notifying their customers, that their data is going to be used in such a way. That's difficult for a lot of companies to understand, maybe in retail, certainly in manufacturing, where their customer base is much more segmented. It's not an individual normally, it's another store that's buying product, but they still have customer information, et cetera. So it gets a little bit challenging to communicate that to our end clients that we service. Let me circle back. Privacy is very challenging because depending on which regulatory requirement, and here's where we'll get in the regional differences very quickly, GDPR certainly has some very huge restrictions and certain controls that have to be in place. Some would argue that GDPR, again, it depends on who you talk to, but GDPR is probably the most stringent of the regulations to date globally. If you take a look at the new Japanese, Australian, and the Chinese privacy laws or the Chinese cybersecurity law, they're starting to adopt the controls within GDPR. If you make the assumption here that the GDPR regulatory requirements are the most stringent, then it seems to me that if you operate into meeting those requirements, you should probably exceed all the regulatory requirements of individual countries. Or pretty close. There's probably some nuances that you have to do something differently. That becomes important for us as we talk about our managed security capabilities and then advanced analytics. At what point, if you're meeting all the requirements from GDPR, is there anything else that takes it a step farther in any individual country or region? Data residency comes immediately to mind. So there's different data residency requirements. But if we're getting all this data, and our job as a security company is to collate all this data to give all of our clients the benefit of what's going on globally, then you have to look at the data together. That becomes difficult, and that's where I come back to anonymization. Because once we anonymize the data, then the hope is that based on regulatory requirements, we can put that together and do that analytical capability globally. That's our current challenge, how to best do that to meet all the regional requirements. I think we've got that solved. My hope is that we've got it solved today. In the meantime, we have to worry about where that data resides at and make sure that we have the capability. If an individual company says they don't want their data to leave, let's say Australia, we have to have the capability in our systems for that data to stay in Australia. So our current platform that's beginning to roll out today has that capability where we will do data tagging. So that data then will be tagged based on country. And so that data then will reside. It will not go on the cloud, if you will, and get combined in another location to do advanced analytics. Now, advanced analytics is still done, but it's done on the data locally within that solution set on the ground in that country. These are unique challenges for a security company. I'm sure some of these challenges exist for companies as a whole, regardless of what their vertical marketplace is, because they're going to have to deal with the same issues. Privacy, again, just to recap, is a very big area of concern for us. We take it seriously. We're providing our solutions to make sure that we do manage security and privacy of each individual customer, and we work with our clients to make sure that they're doing the proper notifications.
So far, you've convinced me I don't want to be a global CISO. So if I were to ask you just to give me a few things that global CISOs really need to put top of their agenda to get control of their situation, what would they be?
I can answer that question only based on experience in the financial sector previous to this, and then as a current global CISO for a security company within a much broader umbrella of a global company. And I'll repeat a couple of things I said earlier. First of all, I think it's important that your location within the organization, where do you sit at within the organization? If you're a global CISO, it seems to me that falling under a global CIO at four levels underneath where the executive decisions are made is not a good place to be, in my opinion. And I think it's important for people to think through that. So how do you change that? Well, that's educating the board of directors. That's educating the executive team of however that company is organized. That's one challenge, and I think that's one thing people should address. If you're a brand new global CSO that just got hired, you have a little bit more flexibility to say, here's the things I think need to go based on your experience. You can have that conversation early on. If you're already there and you've been there for a year or maybe a number of years, it's, I think, much more of a challenge to convince them. If it's already working, why not fix it? My argument there would be, I'm not sure it's already working. And so therefore, you have to really build up some political capital to have that conversation in a very detailed frame. That's the first challenge, and I think CISO should address that. The second challenge, of course, is going to be the cultural impact and how do you use that best to your advantage. And I think that is really based on communication. In my opinion, a global CISO is best when they are visiting all the locations that they have, if that's possible. I would not recommend my travel schedule to anybody. Last year, I was on the road about 44 weeks for the year, all across the globe, meeting with all of the locations that we have, just so I can understand what their needs are, and our employees have a face to who the global CISO is. I think that's important. So making sure that you're involved in understanding what the cultures are and how to get information to those individuals, because I believe that the employees of every company are the first line of defense. They're out there, they're day-to-day working very, very hard, they see a lot of things, and they have to have the ability to give you feedback, that information. And if they don't and they hold it themselves or they only give it to their manager, generally never gets up to the global CISO level. Again, the way I'm organized, I have an advantage, I think, because I've organized where I have regional CISOs. They have the title, and people can go to them directly, and then those people flesh out that reporting and bring that up to me at the global level. We talk about that at least once a month, and generally, my team has those discussions once a quarter with everybody, not just the four regional CISOs. Leveraging the culture with training, with communications back and forth, I think is a second area. A third area is if you're a big global business, one of the things that a global CSO should be concerned about is acquisitions. Mergers and acquisitions. Generally speaking, the CSO is not involved in that conversation early on. It's usually an afterthought. I think that's a bad way of doing business because one of the most important impacts to finalizing an acquisition, of course, is cost. And if the CISO team doesn't get a chance to review that target company for either a merger or acquisition and look at it from a security perspective, a design perspective, you're not going to necessarily know how much money is going to take to bring it up to par to meet your current control standards. That company may be okay, it may not be. Generally speaking, and again, this is my experience, when we acquire companies, generally, their security controls are somewhat lacking because they're concerned about getting the company sold. So they have not made a lot of investments late in the process prior to the acquisition. Things like replacement of their Windows operating systems is probably low on the priority list. It probably hasn't been done. When you start taking a look at the cost, you could talk about a 1 or 2% or maybe even up to a 10% difference of cost in the total acquisition price because you have to put that in after the fact. So when you find out about it, now you've got to make the investment after the purchase. That hits the bottom line differently depending on how the company calculates their books. But I think it's better off to have that money in the acquisition cost. From a shareholder perspective, you're giving them the actual cost of the acquisition versus a certain payment. Let's say it's $10 million you bought the company and then you had to input another $3 million on the back end. That was unforeseen cost. That hits the books differently in most cases. And so I think the global CISOs have an opportunity to provide the business with a view that's going to help them get to the true cost of an acquisition. So that's number three. Certainly, number four, at least in my view, is really around people in the sense of security people. Everybody that is in our business certainly knows that security talent is very difficult right now. And I don't see that getting any better. In the Americas, I think we have about 1.2 million openings for security professionals of various disciplines that aren't filled today. That number has to be bigger globally. I don't have that at the top of my fingertips. But when I use Americas as that baseline, getting talent and getting that talent established and getting on your team is difficult for everybody. And sooner rather than later, we are competing against the same talent for the same jobs. And we're not necessarily impacting the growing of our own talent, which is a way to go. We're not, in my view, capitalizing on talent that already exists within your own business. That talent may be working in marketing currently. Instead, you want to bring that along into the security space as an example. Integrated with the cultural aspect is, where do we get that talent from? The educational institutions, are they growing that talent fast enough that we all can take advantage of a talent pool that's up and coming? That's a huge challenge for global CISOs, because you can't hire a bunch of security professionals in a single country and expect them to be successful globally. You must have talent that's spread out across the globe, because those aspects and view of the cybersecurity threat, the landscape, is going to be sometimes totally different. And it's better to have, back to your comment, openness where you can collaborate versus target it from a very finite perspective, a very specific view. Combining those two to get talent and manage talent, I think, is another crucial area for global CISO. And you'll notice I haven't really talked about technical stuff at this point. Number five would be certainly the technical aspects of cybersecurity control, what solutions you're using, how you're implementing those across the globe, certainly is another challenge and another area of concern. That whole idea of technical really, to me, is security architecture, and then what I've already termed as security by design. Everywhere that there's a project, you have to have the ability as a CISO office, and again, this has to do with the amount of staff you have, but in my particular case, when a project is decided by the project board that it's going to become a project, I have a security person that's assigned to that. Maybe myself, it may be somebody else that says, okay, what is the project? What's the security implications? Do we need to worry about XYZ control? Do we need to have a separate technical solution that we have to implement, etc.? And that's security by design. So all of our projects within Entity Security have some security review right at the beginning. And then if it's necessary for security controls to be changed from what we already have, or that project requires some specialty, then we'll provide resources through that entire project lifecycle. So internally, that becomes very important. And so security by design, the security architecture of our company, is very critical. Our clients are relying on us to be secure. We have challenges like every other company, but if we do security by design, I think we're eliminating some of the nuances that occur when security is five or six levels underneath and doesn't really get looked at as a business, as a function. We've done a good job in that. Do we have a lot of work to do? I think every company has a lot of work to do. I don't think we're any exception. We've got a lot of challenges. We're integrating companies continuously. The good news is I don't have a sales force. So my sales force, which is an entirely different topic, is with the operational companies. Less of a challenge for me if I don't have a sales team. So those would be the top five that I think of off the top of my head.
John, thank you for your time today.
Very good.